You are listening to Pastor Talk.
In the inner city, the narrative, as you read, is often, if it's familiar, it's a failure. Staying is an indicator of not having been able to get yourself out of the black hole of the inner city.
Welcome to Pastor Talk, the podcast of Lifeway Pastors, giving you the tools and encouragement you need to shepherd your flock well. I'm your host, Marty Duran.
I am super glad to welcome Rich Pettis to Pastor Talk today. Rich is a pastor in New York City, and I don't interview a lot of people from New York City, being down here in Nashville and situated in the South. So, brother, I am really glad to have you on today.
Well, man, I'm glad that you got a New Yorker on the podcast.
And while we were talking, before I remembered to hit record, we discovered that it's a lot colder in Nashville today than it is in New York City. So, you know, write your own global warming theme in there for that, I guess. But I do appreciate on your behalf the fact that you have such a beautiful day outside up there.
Oh, we are too. It's pretty cloudy, but it's warmer than we expected. So we're glad to.
That's awesome. Okay, so why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself? You're in, I jokingly said, all I know about New York City, I've learned from Law and Order, which is absolutely the truth, because I've never been to New York State that I know of, unless it was through the airport. Never been to New York City, never been on the island. I know nothing except my friends that visit there love it. So tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of where you're situated related to some of the other areas, boroughs, or whatever people might be familiar with.
Yeah. So I am the husband to an incredible wife, Anna. We've now been married for 10 years. We've got two incredible kids. Josiah, who's my little superhero, he's 9, and Hayden, who's my little princess, she's 5. Those guys all mean the world to me. They've helped me to, I know this is cliche, but they've helped me to be the person that I am today, and I really mean mm-hmm. that. Just in every respect, how they've sharpened me as a person, but also as a we live in a neighborhood called Inwood, which is in the broader area of Washington Heights, which is what locals call Uptown. So okay. I gave you three names of where we're situated. Right? Inwood is the actual neighborhood where we live in. The broader area is called Washington Heights, the congressional district, you can say. But the locals call it all Uptown.
Okay.
So that's where we have been as a family for the last 8 years. I personally have been in this neighborhood 29 of my 33 years. My parents immigrated here from the Dominican Republic mm-hmm. in 1981. I came in 84. And my family has kind of planted their roots here and established a life and a rhythm here in New York. And so have many other Caribbean immigrants. This is a heavily Hispanic neighborhood.
The
face of it is changing, and I'm sure we'll get to that at some point. The face of it is changing. We've got a lot more second and third generation Hispanics like myself, but this is where we are. My wife and I 7 years ago with some family and friends decided that we wanted to plant a church, respond to God's call to plant the church. And we started gathering a team, vision casting, talking, having meals together, studying the word together, making touches with the community. For those 2 years, we decided to go public with our Sunday services. And so we recently celebrated 5 years as a church. This past December, we sent our associate pastor to plant the church in Harlem, which is the community below us. That's probably a more renowned community.
Yeah.
More people know that community. He and his family just had their very first Sunday back in September. So in a short amount of time, we've planted a church, made touches with the neighborhood, and planted a second church. God has been incredibly kind to us over the years, and we're happy to be here. So.
That's awesome. Now, I think Chris Rock was raised in Bed-Stuy. Is that near you?
It is not, my brother. I love Chris Rock, but he's from Brooklyn, man. Brooklyn. So Uptown are like Brooklyn is a world away. You got to jump on the train an hour before you get the best time.
Yeah, that's a really good, and we've already talked about a mutual friend who's in Flatbush that you said is about an hour away by the train. So for people like me who've never been to New York City and everything has just been, you know, pictures of the Statue of Liberty or something like that, kind of give an idea about what the population is like. I mean, a lot of my listeners are in rural areas where, you know, there'll be 10,000 people in the county seat town. We live in Nashville, which is, I guess, rapidly approaching a million or something like that. And we're adding a bunch of people every day. But when we start talking about New York City and population, it's a whole different kind of a ball game. We've gone from, you know, basketball and football to soccer. How do you think about the number of people that are around you? Say if there's a 1 mile radius around your house, how many people live in that 1 mile radius?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So from recent surveys, the last number that I know is as of 2 years ago, in a 1 mile radius, we have 290,000 people.
Wow.
We have 290,000 people in a 1 mile radius to where we live. There's just, I want to say, just over 2 million people on the island of Manhattan, which is 11 miles long, I think 4 miles wide.
Mm-hmm.
There is, in the city of New York, which, you know, including the five boroughs, mm-hmm. you know, Manhattan, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island, I think we have just over 13 million.
Good.
And in the metropolitan area, New York, which would include parts of Jersey, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania, that's, I want to say, 21 million. So, densed, my brother. Packed well, in and stacked well. High.
That is amazing. So, yeah. Your book is Mi Casa Uptown. My house or my home uptown. You affirmed my rudimentary translation before I hit record. I'm really interested. I'm really interested in your focus on the word familiarity. I'm going to read a brief excerpt and then ask you to talk about kind of how you're using that term and how you want familiarity to breed love instead of contempt. So here's the excerpt. Familiarity seemed like the death of every inner city kid. If it was familiar, it was probably because you didn't do enough to get yourself out of the neighborhood. I wanted to share my story about growing up in the inner city of New York and capture all the hardship and beauties about growing up here. I wanted to tell the story that's not often told, the story about staying. I wanted to pull from it valuable lessons that I've learned. God has had his hands in the mix and his kindness is worth talking about. End of the quote. And the question that comes up then is, what if instead of contempt, familiarity bred love? Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So really at the heart of the book is this desire to retell the narrative of the inner city, especially for the inner city kid of color, person of color. In the inner city, the narrative, as you read, is often, if it's familiar, it's a failure. Staying is an indicator of not having been able to get yourself out of the black hole of the inner city. Historically, we've seen how the inner city has either been neglected, under-resourced, and as a result, it just becomes this place where very few people want to be, including the ones that are there. The challenge is that for the inner city kid, you don't know any other story. You don't know any narrative. You don't have any other narrative encouraging you to succeed or thrive in the least. And so at the heart of the book is the retelling of a narrative saying, hey, I'm going to talk as gritty and as raw about the inner city narrative, but use that as a means not to discourage that narrative, but to say that you can exist in it and retell the story with a different ending. Familiarity does not have to breed contempt, mm-hmm. as the old saying goes. What if the good, the bad, the ugly, and the hopeless can actually compel us toward beauty and toward love and toward investment rather than disinvestment, rather than frustration, rather than a kind of this spiraling down. And I really do believe that as a believer, as a pastor, of course, I think that the key to allowing familiarity to breed love rather than contempt is the story of Christ. Mm-hmm. I think Christ looked at the world that he created, what it had become, and seeing how far it has gone from what he intended, he saw the bad, he saw the ugly. I think it's part of Romans 8:5, right? While we were still sinners, God demonstrated his love. God looked at the darkness of his creation and chose to still demonstrate love and so I think at the heart of that shift, at the heart of that paradigm shift, to breed love rather than contempt is the narrative of the gospel, where you can be deeply familiar with the unloveliness of a thing and still die for its loveliness so that it would be made lovely. And so, yeah.
How difficult is it proving to change that narrative in Uptown?
Oh, yeah, incredibly difficult. I think not just in Uptown, in any narrative, you know what I mean? It's hard. It's hard to help folks to see that your unloveliness or your brokenness or your darkness can actually be used for something incredible, mm-hmm. can actually be leveraged for something extraordinary, can actually be used for life, mm-hmm. right? No one would look at death and assume life. No one would look at darkness and assume that light can come from it. But again, I feel like passages like John 1:5, right? The darkness has not overcome the light. You know, mm-hmm. those that kind of narrative convinces me that it's possible. But it is challenging. It is challenging, you know, from the in the Christian culture, it's challenging to help folks see that critically and thoughtfully. And outside of the Christian culture, it's a challenge because people want better, people want good. And somehow, most of my conversations with non-believers, they're convinced that, you know, the grass is just greener on the other side of the street, you know,
yeah.
on the other side. You know, outside of the inner city, the grass is green. And so it just becomes in both conversations, both to the, you know, the community that doesn't hold your convictions and values as a believer and worldview. And even within the Christian community, I think it's, you know, it's dynamic, it's complex to help people to truly see that the inner city and its narrative can be beautiful, you know, so.
In your 1 mile radius of 290,000 packed tight and stacked high souls, how many churches are there that are, you know, I don't mean to disparage, but just, let's just say this, there are some that are alive and trying to reach people with the gospel rather than just, you know, had been there for 100 years and they're just there. Are there other, I see the name of your church is Christ Crucified Fellowship. Are there other churches like Christ Crucified Fellowship that really are seeing the benefit of staying, or that they've planted and they're seeing the benefit of immersing themselves with a gospel orientation? Or are you out there like mostly by yourself?
No, not at all. There are incredible churches in this 1 mile radius that are, they're taking what I talk about in the book, you know, a Jeremiah 29 kind of philosophy, you know, stay here for years in Babylon is what God told the exiles, and they couldn't fathom what that meant. you know, these are our enemies. How could you invite us to stay here and actually create a life here and build a legacy? No, there are several churches, both that kind of resemble a kind of younger, perhaps, philosophy of ministry approach in church to those that are perhaps a little more conservative and been around for a while. I mean, church that I came to know Jesus as a late teenager and was discipled under is a Spanish Southern Baptist church, and they are a pillar in this community. you know, they've got 900 strong in a building that, you know, could fit no more than 400. So they have several services.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're a staple in the community. And so Spanish speaking, because of the demographics that we, but also English speaking, perhaps, you know, new approach to philosophy of ministry. We've got several.
That's awesome. So
yeah.
A lot of folks who are listening to this podcast won't have 290,000 people in their county. Maybe not in that part of their state. So it's a different group, smaller churches, more rural or even suburban, outside. So they're not coming to New York City. The idea of that many people just makes them break out in hives just to think about it. How does your philosophy or your thinking about familiarity and familiarity leading to love, how does that apply in other contexts?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you know, as I was writing it, one of the biggest challenges that I had was thinking, how can someone outside of a city context enjoy this book? The first thing that I said is, I think it's good even for the rural and suburbanite to wrestle through this book, because I feel like the worlds are coming to us. Mm-hmm. And I think to some degree, even the rural places of our country are affected by globalization. Mm-hmm. And so the city touches every part. And by the city, I mean not just New York, but the city environment touches, it seems, almost every part of our country, whether you're suburban or rural or in the city itself. So I think that's, you know, one reason that I think anybody can pick up the book and read it and glean from it some. The other perhaps primary reason that I think it's important is because while I talk about my city experience in New York, as unique as that experience may be in comparison to most of our country, I'm really pushing principles. The principle of family, the principle of rootedness, mm-hmm. the principle of incarnation. You don't need to be in a city. You don't need to have 290,000 people in a 1 mile radius to be faithful to the call of incarnation or hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk a lot about hospitality because it seems like the U.S. South has had a handle on hospitality.
Y'all come.
Right. Whereas Northerners can't really be hospitable in that sense. And I talk a lot about hospitality because I think I push the bounds of how I interpret that word.
Mm-hmm.
How I think what biblical hospitality is, that it involves a lot of what we see our Southern brothers and sisters doing, but I think it isn't reduced to that.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't reduced to opening the doors of your home, because in New York City, some of us barely have doors. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so if that's
yeah.
the case, then only a few people can truly be hospitable. But if we define hospitality with a broader stroke, then that allows anyone, regardless of what your space, physical space looks like, you can be hospitable to. So the principles of family, the principle of radical hospitality, the principles of radical investment and city, the principles of rootedness and incarnation are not, you know, the city's not privy to that, you know,
mm-hmm.
anyone in any situation, in any context can apply those. And so I think those principles is what I'm pushing. You'll just have to do the hard labor of reading my inner city stories and finding your own in that. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
I know a literary technique is not, you know, I'm going to just share my story because I know well. But in that story, I think I do a good job at making the principle clear. You, as the reader, will have to do the hard work of finding yourself in my story.
But the funny thing, as we're talking here, and you're talking about place and being rooted and all that, that's Wendell Berry. I mean, Wendell Berry lives on a farm in Kentucky, and he's writing the exact same thing that you're talking about in a different context. Now, I was never taught any of this. Never. My dad grew up on a farm, but by the time I was old enough to know anything, we lived in the suburbs of Atlanta. He worked in a factory producing automobiles, and I grew up in a suburban area. Now, it wasn't like hyper-populated. It was a small suburb, but it was still a suburb. And so I was taught from the earliest years of my life that You know, you're always on call to go where God wants you to be. Don't get too comfortable somewhere because God might, you know, call you to Alaska or God might call you to Belarus or somewhere like that. So don't get too comfortable. You know, don't plug in. You know, always stay ready to move. And then as I've gotten older, I've started reading more thinking along the line of what you're espousing, that you do need to immerse yourself in a place. You need to be with a people in a place. You need to let yourself become melded, for lack of a better word, into a community. And so are those things contradictory, or is there a sense of being the citizen of two worlds that's at work here and we just have to constantly deal with that tension?
It's at odds, do you mean our citizenship here and whatever that context looks like, and then our citizenship with the Lord?
Absolutely. How do we stay constantly ready to be an ambassador for Christ wherever he might send us, while at the same time we're immersing ourselves in a people in a place, but not getting so comfortable that if he moves us that we're reticent to go, but we're actually with a people. So you're actually in Uptown, you're there. But if God says to you, hey, enough of that, I'm moving you to South Dakota. You know, after you have a season of weeping and fasting to change his mind, you up and go to South Dakota. When you get there, hearing you talk, you are once again going to find a people and a place. You're going to immerse yourself there. So it seems that's like that two citizenship tension.
Yeah, that's such a layered question. It's a really helpful question. So I think a few things. One, I think that tension will always exist. I just think it'll always be there, because I think that our citizenship demands us to be faithful citizens. We are here and now. This was the gripe that Paul had with the Thessalonians, where they said, oh, we're on our way to heaven. Yeah. You know, might as well not do anything. And Paul wrote an entire letter saying, no way, brothers. It's because of citizenship that you ought to live, you know, plentifully and faithfully here and now. So I think to one degree, our divine citizenship demands us to be faithfully invested. Again, to use Jeremiah 29, I think that God, you know, gives us this command oftentimes to be planted in a foreign land, right? And in a bigger, broader application of that text, we are in a sense in a foreign land. This isn't the city that we are journeying to, though it's the city where we are in. And so there has to be commitment there to be established. You know, the other thing that I think is, in our Western frame of thinking, as much as we may not like this, I think that we are driven by a consumption mindset, consumerist mindset. We're also driven by a very individualistic mindset. And I think those two things are two kind of big pillars that we have to often resist. And so part of me convinced that while I believe that God may call someone and them and plant them out and send them out, I want to believe that we're in a era or in a season of church history where the call might be to stay more than it is to go. You know what I mean? I think that we, in our Western framework, where there's so much transiency and so much individual perspective, we have, because of that, lost our sense of rootedness. That God was clearly trying to establish even with the exiles, and to a degree that Jesus was even trying to establish with mission when he says first Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth, right? I feel like locality is what breeds kind of global impact as I read that text. And individualism, I feel like we just lost the communal aspect of our call. Our journey with Jesus far too individual. You know, God has been saying this from the very beginning, even to Moses, when he says that his desire was for his people to be a kingdom of priests. That's communal language. Our holiness, we only understand it personally, rather than understanding holiness as a communal attribute. And so I think all of those things kind of put together, there's going to be this tension because we're on our way toward a city while still being planted in a city. And I think it's healthy to say that I really do think that God is calling us to be more rooted in seasons like these. Because, man, in my opinion, I think influence, compassion and leadership will always precede influence. And I think what the church is trying to do, it's trying to have influence before it establishes relationship. But relationships take time. And
right.
Those kind of things, we want... You know, it's interesting because I think we want the impact, but are not committed to work, to waiting for what impact often requires on the back end.
Yeah, it's kind of like that old idea of drive-by evangelism. You know, if you give somebody the track and if they don't get saved on the spot, then you just move on to the next person. And it's like that first person never existed. It does take time to build the kind of relationships that make people interested in what I have to say, not just a captive to my rambling, you know, at the food counter.
Yeah.
So the last chapter of your book is called Trust Jesus, Die Well. I do want to thank you for it not being Trust Jesus, Die Now. Because I am kind of enjoying this deal a little bit. So, I mean, honestly, you know, even Christians don't often like to think about death. I'm in my mid-50s now. We have a lot of seniors that I'm friends with at our church that are in their 60s and 70s and 80s. And as I get older, even though I'm still not in that senior adult phase, I do become more aware of some of the things that they're going through because they are nearing the end of their earthly race. And, you know, their friends are dying around them. So if a 20-year-old, 30-year-old, 40-year-old, 50-year-old is thinking about trusting Jesus and dying well, what can you tell them to encourage them along that path?
Yeah. Well, you know, in that chapter, you know, I share a lot of personal stories and what actually, you know, compelled me to think more about death, you know, mainly my mom's passing back in 2007. But I asked myself two questions, and that, you know, this is not revolutionary. I think Paul makes these two questions come to life in Philippians. But I said, what is life and death? And I had to ask myself critically those two questions, critically on them. And I would encourage people, no matter age, in kind of adulthood age, and, you know, honestly, even my kids at 9 and 5, it's not like we're obsessively talking about life and death
right
at home. But I think being able to introduce the reality of what life and what is death, even at their age, what can conversation about that look like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's up to parents to determine. But my encouragement is ask yourself those two questions and think critically about them through the lens of your experiences and ultimately through the lens of scripture. Because I think when you define what life, you automatically define what death is. When you say that life is, for example, you know, to gain success, then death in a sense is anything that comes in the way of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not getting a promotion, a coworker, you know, whatever have you. I think that determining and having language and clarity on what is life will ultimately get you clarity on what is death. And, you know, when you go through some life experiences, you begin to you come back to that question almost every time because you define life in one way and then something happens, something, you know, critical happens in your life and you're like, wait, I have to come ask this question again, and find the answer to that. But my encouragement is wrestle through those two questions. I think in the Christian worldview, the comfort is that, as Paul said, life is Christ,
mm-hmm.
and death is a gain, right? So no longer am I held captive to define life by a thing that I possess
mm-hmm.
or that possesses me, but rather now life is defined by who Christ is and what he has accomplished. And that gives me utmost comfort because I know that even death can't take that definition away from me. And now, whether I'm a 33-year-old, a 25, or a 55-year-old, or an 80-year-old, and death comes knocking on my door, or he abruptly shows up to take me, you know, this is, you know, tongue in cheek. I've not had a near death experience, but my hope is that my definition of life will gird me, you know, and equip me to say, I'm sure this will be tough, but I will see the other side.
That's awesome.
And that's comforting to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? No matter the age, you know, of course, like you said, I don't want to die now. I think God is very kind and he's blessed me here, but I do want to die well whenever that happens.
That's always been to me one of those weird tension things that just comes with being a believer, I guess, that, you know, I think I'm ready to die at any time. I mean, I think if the Lord calls me, I'm ready to go, but I enjoy life. I mean, I think that he wants us to enjoy what he's given us here. Otherwise, you know, he just snatched us up the minute we got saved and let somebody else do the hard work, you know? I struggle with, I guess, not that I love the stuff of life at all. I mean, I really don't care much about it, but I do love life. I mean, I like my friends and my family and my kids and my grandson, my wife. I want to see them. I want to be with them. And the thought of being absent from them is hurtful. So there's I'm always brought back to 1 Corinthians where scripture says death is an enemy. It's a bridge for those of us who are believers for sure. But it's an enemy to relationships. It's an enemy to friendships. And so I do want to die well, but, you know, I'm not even joking when I say I don't want to die yet. I mean, I'm not ready to go.
I'm with you. You know, one of the things I say in the book is when you hold that perspective, right, where life is Christ and death is just a gain. I mean, the way I understand it and the way I share it in the book is when you hold that worldview, death becomes an advocate, an accidental advocate, mm-hmm. you know, to your life. And I think, you know, I mean, this has so many kind of eschatological implications and what is after, what is life now? What does it mean to have the kingdom of God here at hand? What did Jesus mean by that? I'm not sure if you're a Stranger Things fan, but I am. And that Netflix series that's kind of been taking over the world, it seems. But there's a really cool concept in that series. Talks about worlds coming together.
The
upside down is literally under the nose of the very people that are walking, you know, living life in Hawkins, Indiana, not knowing that there's another dimension right where they are that's called the upside down. And of course, anyone who watches that, there's that one character that essentially bridges those two worlds. She can exist in both. Mm-hmm. And she almost seems like the bridge to both. Mm-hmm. And so I think in a sense, the life that we live now, those things that you deeply value, which are true and good and praiseworthy, relationships, grades, you know, being able to pick up basketball with my son, all those things are so deeply profound and beautiful and I think meaningful that they serve a purpose in the kingdom. And I think, you know, living life through the lens of Christ and his gospel allows us to kind of see both worlds. It's kind of when we say heaven on earth, that's that expression mm-hmm. after being your granddaughter and you're like embracing her and she says, Papa, and she hugs you and you're like, oh my gosh, I want to just bottle this moment up because it needs to be like heaven on earth.
Yeah.
And to agree, I think it kind of is.
Yeah, right?
This
I agree.
Little glimpse and this little taste of this upside down world that's right under our nose until Jesus comes and says, no longer will it be just another dimension. No longer will it be just right under your nose. I'm actually coming to establish it fully and clearly right here, right now. And it kind of exists already here. And I think that's what Jesus meant.
That's awesome. My guest today on Pastor Talk has been Rich Perez, the pastor of Christ Crucified Fellowship in Washington Heights.
That's right.
New York.
Yeah.
And author of the new, I think you're like, wait, October or this month release date for Mikasa Uptown?
Yeah, no, it released November 1st, so it's only been about 3 weeks.
Okay, fantastic. And you can get it through Amazon or Lifeway.com. Do you know if it's going to be in like any of the, like Barnes & Noble or Walmart or any of those?
Yeah, yeah. So it's in Barnes & Noble. I believe it's in Walmart, but the big chain, Barnes & Noble and Amazon are probably the biggest, the two biggest chains. Yeah.
Excellent. So check it out. And this is going to be a belated Happy Thanksgiving, but you'll hear this soon. And Christmas will be coming up when you do. And I hope everyone has a great Christmas as well. Rich, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Pastor Talk is the podcast of Lifeway Pastors and is hosted by Marty Duran. That's me. Join us each week as I interview pastors, authors, professors, and others to help your ministry as you seek to shepherd your flock well. Until next time, this is Marty Duran.